QuakerDotCom podcast. Today is Thursday, October 10th, 2012, and my name is Ben Stone. This is podcast number 214, and it's the third in a series where I'm talking about two topics that have come up in email and on the Bad Quaker website. How are children's rights protected in a free society, and how are law and justice established in a free society? Before we get into that, let me just say, first off, you're listening to the wrong podcast. You need to immediately get over to kittyfeet.com to Michael W. Dean's Anarchy Gumbo podcast, and you need to immediately download Michael's interview with guitar legend and just really, really super cool person in general, Dick Dale. I was just listening to that podcast just a couple minutes ago, and it was just blowing me away. I couldn't, you know, just hearing Dick Dale talk about his life and his experiences, and wow, it's amazing. So, if you insist on listening to this podcast, then okay, well, that's fine. But whatever you do, you need to get over there to Kitty Feet and download Michael's interview with Dick Dale, because that just, wow, that was something else. Dick Dale is such an amazing individual. But in the rare occasion that somebody might still be listening to me talk, I'll go ahead and throw out a few things here. And speaking of Michael Dean, he's kind enough to donate to BadQuaker.com a DVD that we're going to be giving away called Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1, Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz. This is a great new DVD that Michael put together with Jared Waltz. And it covers not only basic handgun and rifle handling, but this new twist that he's got in there with thinking of gun training with the non-aggression principle. It's really good DVD. It's really worth spending the time to watch it. And it's certainly worth the, I think it's about $20 to buy it or something like that. It's well worth that money. But you can win a free copy of it. And that's what I'm going to tell you about. And in addition to a free copy of that wonderful DVD, you can also win a BadQuaker.com t-shirt. It's black with gold-colored letters on the back that say BadQuaker.com. And so how do you win this? You go to Facebook and you look for BadQuaker.com, spelled D-O-T-C-O-M. You find the Bad Quaker Facebook page, and you post on the Bad Quaker Facebook page this phrase: I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD. You post that on BadQuaker.com's Facebook page, and if you don't have a Facebook account, you can email BadQuaker@BadQuaker.com, put DVD in the subject line, and put, I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD in the body of the email. Now, we won't sell, trade, or do anything else stupid or evil with your email address. We will respect your privacy there. Now, Michael W. Dean and I will randomly choose a winner next Sunday, October 14th, 2012. So this has to be done. If you're listening to this in an archive, this contest ends Sunday, October 14th, 2012, when Michael and I randomly choose a winner. This is for U.S. addresses only. We can't mail these outside of the U.S. You must be 21 or over to enter the contest. No purchase is necessary. It's not valid where prohibited by evil overlords. And the DVD and the t-shirt will be mailed separately, so you'll get them in two separate packages. So if one shows up and the other's not there, don't worry, the other one will show up. But we'll notify you ahead of time if you're the winner. We'll get back in touch with you. Okay, now let's get into the podcast here. Oh, I wanted to mention one other thing, too, and I've been teasing this for a couple days now. I did an interview with William Anderson, Bill Anderson. He's a writer for LouRockwell.com, and he's also an associate professor of economics at Frostburg State University. And that's going to be, we're probably going to have that edited and up on the website for Friday's podcast. So be sure and download that as well. Okay, so let's get into the topic here. Now, as in the previous two episodes in this series, I want to let you know my sources for what I'm talking about to a large degree come from For a New Liberty, the Libertarian Manifesto by Murray Rothbard, Chaos Theory by Bob Murphy, Robert P. Murphy, and both of those, there'll be links in today's show notes at badquaker.com for all of these sources. And both of those two sources, the links go to Amazon, where you can actually purchase those books if you'd like to. Or you can get free downloads of For a New Liberty, the Libertarian Manifesto over at Mises.org. And then in addition to those two books, there's an online article, and again, this will be posted in today's show notes. There's an online article called The Obviousness of Anarchy by John Hassness, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his name. And he is the associate professor of law at Georgetown University School of Law. And also, I'm making references to things I've learned from a Roderick Long, actually quite a few different Roderick Long articles and lectures that he's done, but one particular called Privatization Viking Style, Model or Misfortune. Now, you can read that entire article. Follow the links on today's show notes, and they'll take you to the Bad Quaker page where that article is printed. And then also, if I get a chance near the end of the podcast, I'm going to talk about the article I wrote that's called Why Must the State Forbid the Duel? And again, links, whether or not I get time to talk about that, the link will be in today's show notes so you can go over and read it for yourself. And I think there's an audio version of it as well. So now in the first podcast in this series, I tried to focus on the failure of the current aggression-based system. In the second podcast, I talked more about those failures, and I also offered some examples of contract law that currently exists outside of that aggressive system. I talked about user agreements and voluntary binding arbitration between banks and companies and between service providers and consumers. Companies like PayPal offer their services with the stipulation that you agree to settle disputes with a third-party arbitrator rather than a government court. Now, what I didn't mention, and I meant to, but I forgot about it, but what I didn't mention is that because we're stuck with this aggressive government system that we currently have, there are flaws built into these agreements, the agreement between PayPal and the consumers or between these others, because the government allows cheating. Governments basically throughout levels of government, there's ways to allow cheating. It's sort of part of government. Well, as a matter of fact, if you have an organization that's based on theft and aggression, how can it not be based on cheating? So, or how can it not involve cheating? So because there is a system based on aggression, then there are ways to get around these voluntary arbitrations. Of course, that wouldn't exist in a free society where there was no aggressive state. These agreements like this between organizations or between companies or between people and so forth would have a whole lot more power than they have now, because the system that we have now, if you're rich enough, you can get out of these different agreements in one way or the other. You can buy your way out of it. If you have enough money to hire enough lawyers and you can tie things up in court for long enough, it pretty much doesn't matter what kind of agreement you signed or what kind of agreement you agreed to. If you have enough money and enough lawyers under the current system, you can tie things up until everybody involved in the process is dead. So, and that's strictly because we do have a system that allows cheating that's based on aggression and theft and so forth. If the governmental system wasn't here, then that out wouldn't be available in voluntary arbitration. And And one mistake that people fall into when they consider these things is they get tied up in the details of how a free society could work, and they forget that the real issue is the evil nature of the current system. And I talked a lot about that in the last two episodes, but really, this is where the well-used phrase comes in, who would pick the cotton? You'll hear that phrase kicked around almost as a joke among anarcho-capitalists. Yeah, who would pick the cotton? It's kind of an inside joke. It shouldn't be an inside joke. It should be something that's obvious to everyone. Now, the argument kind of goes like this. Slaves have always, you imagine yourself, it's 1840, right? Okay, so slaves have always picked cotton. Cotton is a commodity that's necessary for civilization as we know it. If we end slavery, no one will pick the cotton, therefore civilization will end. So, if you're against slavery, you're against civilization. If you want to end slavery, you want to end civilization. You see how this argument goes? Well, this way of thinking focuses on the need for evil, but it ignores the nature of the market. Near the end of the last podcast, I talked about how the market is actually the desire of people. And if people desire cotton products, the market will produce them. Because somewhere, there's someone who desires something else more than he desires cotton. For whatever reason, he has more cotton than he needs, or cotton is readily available to him, but he desires something more than he desires cotton. So for somebody, it's easier to pick cotton than, say, pick apples. So he's willing to pick cotton so that he can get apples. And this, apples is just an example, but then again, cotton is just an example. So he's willing to work and pick cotton because that's a job that's available to him. And in doing so, and we're assuming a free market, we're not assuming slavery, he's willing to do that because he knows that he can get something he wants by exerting effort into something that he can do and something that's available for him. Now, somebody else might look over and see this guy picking cotton in this field in the hot sun, dragging a bag through the aisles, or through the rows, I'm sorry. And he might look at that and he might think to himself, you know what? If I could think of a way to help this guy pick cotton faster and more efficiently, you know, and in a way that doesn't involve him dragging a bag through the rows and getting his fingers all bloody from slicing them up on the cotton plants. If I could figure out a way to do that, then I would have the kind of an income that I could afford a nice house and all the apples I could eat every day. But so he sees that guy in the field dragging that bag down the row and he says, I think I can come up with an idea on how this can be done. But the end of slavery comes when people choose to abandon an evil system because it's evil, not because someone invents a machine to replace that evil. See, actually, that machine will never get invented so long as there's slaves to fill the need. The evil system of slavery hinders advancement by distorting the market. There's no reason to invent the machine if you've got slaves to do it. You see, it's only when you bring in the profit margins, and it's only when you realize that there are no slaves to do this, that slavery is immoral. And so then people start doing it out of choice. The job still gets done because the need in the market is still there for cotton. But now all of a sudden, maybe the price structure changes on cotton. And maybe that guy picking cotton will make a whole lot more than theoretically what a slave would make. So that drives up the price of cotton. Of course it did. So when the price of cotton goes up, there's a motivation to come up with a way to do the job better. And someone looking at that can go, hey, I can think of a way to do that. And if I do think of a way to do that, I'm going to make a lot of money. But you see that mechanism within the market. Mark Edge just saved me some money. He suggested that I use a special kind of cup that has a locking lid on it so that when I want to drink water, I have to handle that cup specifically. You know, I have to push the button to take a drink out of it. And I just knocked over my cup of water, and it would have gone all over my computer, except Mark Edge suggested I buy a cup and use it like that around my good expensive equipment. And so Mark Edge from Free Talk Live just saved my computer from getting a bunch of water dumped in it. Thanks, Mark. Anyway, so that innovation that exists in the market, I can't remember exactly where I was at in that discussion before I knocked my water glass around, but that motivation is there when there's no aggression. There's a motivation for profit. People want to do everything that they can do to get as much money as possible. And they want to do as much as whatever that they need to do to fill the needs of the market, because the need of the market, they see that. They see that need in the market and they know that that means money for them. So they'll sit down and figure out, how can I do this more efficiently? How can I make something that can do this for me? How can I do 10 rows of cotton at once instead of one row of cotton? And there's a motivation there. But when aggression is there and you have the slaves to do it for you, what motivation could there possibly be? I mean, there might be some small amount of motivation, but nowhere near the amount of motivation that free will produces. The other day, and this is kind of an aside, a different way of looking at this same topic. The other day I read that, now both Google and Apple are spending more on IP issues than they are on research and development. This evil system is hindering advancement by distorting the market. In this case, with Google and Apple, by diverting resources away from research and development and into the pockets of parasites who spend their days picking apart words and phrases to find new ways to sue each other, by doing that, by Google and Apple wasting their money on IP laws and on IP research, and that's intellectual property, by them wasting their money on that, paying lawyers to shuffle through papers, they're not improving their products, they're not widening their product line, and they still may be improving their products and widening their product line, but they're putting more effort into paper shuffling parasites than they are in the actual research and development of what the consumers want. You see, consumers don't want to sit around and contemplate how well Apple's IP rights are protected. Consumers don't really do that. So that's not a need in the market. That's a false need that's created through the aggression of government. So if it weren't for that, Google and Apple and other companies too, pretty much every other company, would have a whole lot more resources to put into research and development of market research and finding out what people want and trying to produce products that fill those needs. But companies are in the grip of fear that someone somewhere may find a way to sue them for something. They fear that some dirty, lazy judge will ask a jury of people who have no knowledge whatsoever of the industry to decide the fate of their company. And that's a terrifying thought for a company. That 12 people, let's say you're in the, let's say you manufacture these cool little cups that I was just talking about with a no-spill lid where you have to push a button to get the lid to open. Let's say you're in the manufacturing business and you manufacture these cups. Well, the manufacturer of that cup has to jump through all kinds of hoops to make sure that there's no small parts that might come off that somebody can swallow and sue them for, or even the potential for that. So that if there is a potential that somebody can gnaw off a chunk of it and accidentally swallow it, then they've got to put some kind of warning label on it. Because you know, you're too stupid to not gnaw off the chunk of plastic and swallow it. So companies have teams of lawyers, sometimes whole buildings full of lawyers, doing nothing but researching legal issues to try to protect the company, because companies are so paranoid about being sued. And why are they being paranoid about being sued? Because they are being sued. Companies get sued for ridiculous things on a regular basis. And that, again, that happens because of the aggression-based system that we're burdened with. Oftentimes, companies prefer the safe route and just do what's already been done rather than to take a risk and try something new. And that's how innovation dies. That's how the future stagnates. That's how the state prevents innovation and prevents the future from being better than the past. And at some point, the saturation point will be reached, and the state will be so oppressive that really almost all innovation will cease because of the state. And at some point, I've talked before about the state, the natural end of the state is either going to be to collapse because people stop believing in it and it'll just evaporate, or it will destroy mankind because mankind needs innovation constantly. Okay, when I get back, we're going to go into this again, so stick with me. I'll be right back.
Would you like to do something to support badquaker.com? Here's how easy it is.
If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to badquaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give badquaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting badquaker.com. Thank you.
Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean, available on Amazon.
Your house is your property.
BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me. Now, yesterday I said that the very things that we're told can't exist without the state, those very things we're told hold society together, are the things that the state fouls up the most. And the two examples that I've been focusing on have been protecting children and providing justice. But that's really just two things in society. By believing in the religion of the government, by believing in the religion of the state, by embracing the faith of aggression, what you're really saying is that you support slavery. Now, that's not just hyperbole. Now, think about this, because really, slavery exists any time a person's time and the fruit of their labor is taken from them without their consent. Any time one person has the power over another person to tell them, come here or go there, or you can't go there, or you need my permission to come and go. Any time you see that, slavery exists. Any time one person can say to another person, let me see what you have there, and I'll decide how much you can keep. That's slavery. And that's what the government does with us right now. Now, think about this. Think about that the government comes to you and says, let me see what you have. Where do you work? How much do you make? How much have you saved this year? How much do you have in savings? How much have you made off of your savings? Do you have any investments that you've made money off of? Have you bought or sold anything that you've produced a profit from? The government asks you those things, and if you don't cooperate and tell them and they find out about it, they'll come after you. Now, would you ask your neighbor these questions? Can you imagine yourself walking up to your neighbor and saying to your neighbor, hey, Bill, how much money you make? Where do you work? How much do you make? Yeah? You have any investments? How much you make on your investment? Could you imagine asking your neighbor these things? But by supporting the state, you have people ask your neighbor those things on your behalf. That's exactly what you're doing. When you support the state, that's what you're supporting. You're supporting the enslavement of not only your neighbor, but of yourself as well. It doesn't matter if that master lives in a big white house on the hill overlooking the plantation, or if that white house is in D.C. or London or Berlin or Beijing. It doesn't matter if the master's will is enforced by strong bosses with vicious hounds and a rawhide whip, or if those strong bosses wear Armani suits and their hounds wear Kevlar vests and swing batons. It doesn't matter if you're kneeling in the sand because you fear the whip of Pharaoh, or if you're kneeling in your own living room because the SWAT team has a gun to your child's head, because some paper pusher at the county building stamped the wrong address on the search warrant. You see, slavery is slavery, even when the slaves have cell phones and Twitter accounts. So you can't let the fear of freedom keep us from seeing the sin of slavery. We can't let ourselves believe that cotton won't be picked without the sting of the master's whip. So how would law and courts work without the aggression of government? Well, all true law, all traditional law before the state interfered, was based on the question of property and aggression. Whose property? Who aggressed? What was the damages resulting? Who's guilty of the damages? These were the basic questions of law. And I've talked before about arrows and how arrows were one of the first indications we have of natural law developing, and how arrows were a symbol of private property, and how individual markings on arrows indicated to everybody else that might find your arrow whose property it was. So if you were hunting and you shot your arrow at a deer, and preferably you're going to have a lung shot. That's what you would shoot for. So your arrow penetrates deep into the lung of the deer, and of course the deer is going to run. That's what he's going to do, because something just jabbed into him. So the deer doesn't die right away. So he runs, and as he runs, his lungs fill with blood, and eventually he'll collapse. Now the hunter will need to follow that blood trail. And, so the hunter follows the blood trail, but sometimes you lose the blood trail. And so if somebody else finds your deer with your arrow stuck in it, then this was an indication. They read your arrow. They could see your markings on the arrow. And this was an indication that not only did the arrow belong to you, but the deer belonged to you as well. And this was a mutually understood arrangement. If you were the kind of person who would steal somebody's deer, well, you were maybe giving their family a death sentence. You know, it's according to how tight things were at the time. Stealing a man's deer that he had taken down, that's a pretty serious thing. When your neighbors find out that you're the kind of a person that would do that, how are they going to treat you? You see, there's a built in a free market, there are built-in mechanisms to push us towards being honest and push us towards respecting private property and the rights of other people. This is the reason, you think about it, why is it that I don't rob banks? Because there's a bank right there, right down the street from me, and I could just go down, I could rob it. That wouldn't be the smart way to do it. If I decided I wanted to rob banks, it wouldn't be that hard to figure out. You just, you get a different vehicle. That would be easy enough. You can steal a vehicle anywhere. They're easy to steal. You steal a vehicle someplace. You drive it maybe halfway across the state or into a different state. You knock off a bank quick and hard. And you're back into the other state, you dump the car somewhere where you have your car stashed, and you drive back home in your own car, and you're safe, and then that's how it's done. And bank robberies happen all the time, and people don't get caught. Only the stupid amateurs get caught. The pros rob banks all the time, and they don't get caught. So why don't I rob banks? I don't rob banks because robbing banks is unethical. I don't rob banks because it's wrong. I don't rob banks because of a choice I make, and it has nothing to do with the police or law enforcement, because I've already demonstrated in what I just said that I could easily rob banks and the cops would never catch me. But I don't rob banks because I choose not to rob banks, and the odds are your neighbor beside you doesn't rob your house, not because he's afraid of cops, but because he doesn't rob houses. Because he has a level of ethics that cause him to respect your property. The same way I was talking about, why don't you go across the street and question your neighbor about his income, about where he works and so forth. And the reason you don't is because you have a natural instinct built within you to know that that's none of your business and you shouldn't bother him like that. That would be rude. Well, the same thing works with enforcement of things like property and aggression in a free society. Deep down inside all of us, we know aggression is wrong, and deep down inside of us, we all have an understanding of property rights. So those people among us in society who would rob a bank, those people don't fear cops. About the only thing they fear is if somebody in that bank happens to be a concealed carry person and is going to pop them in the head when they're looking the other way. That's about the only thing that's the factor that throws off the bank robber that he's not prepared for. But he's not afraid of the cops. They're not a problem. Pretty much any bank robber would know that you've got anywhere from, say, 3 to 10 minutes before the cops are going to arrive. Well, you can knock off a bank in about 3 minutes. So that's a pretty good gamble. And here's a different way of looking at it. Central banks rob us all the time. You know, the very existence of central banks is an act of robbery of the population. Well, what would happen in a free society if there was a central bank that was robbing the people? And there was no aggressive government to protect that central bank? How long do you think a central bank would last? Well, the same thing for any merchant or any business or anything else in a free society where the aggression of government is not available to protect their dishonesty. The rule of law would be the will of the people. And an organization, even, you know, one of the arguments is that, well, certain organization would grow so big that it would overpower everybody. Well, but we don't see that unless you have the aggression of government to support that organization. You take the biggest companies in the world today, and each one of them depends on the aggression of government, because corporations themselves are an aspect of the state. Corporations exist because they rely on the aggression of government to exist. The state makes corporations possible. So now, what would the advantage be to private courts? And how would private courts enforce their will or enforce their judgments in a free society without that aggression of the state? Well, like I was saying, there would be all kinds of market pressures upon all the players involved. To if they agree ahead of time that they're going to go with whatever this court says, and then they fall back on it, and they don't, they fall back on and don't follow through with their word, and they choose not to accept the will of the private courts. Well, then everybody that they do business with after that is going to know that. Is going to know what their nature is. Think about PayPal, companies like PayPal and eBay. Now, first off, eBay came into existence, and then there was a need in the market to have some way of exchanging money that was better, that the banks weren't serving. There was a need there that the banks weren't serving. Some way to move money back and forth quickly and easily, with people who maybe didn't necessarily have the ability to accept credit cards. And so PayPal steps in. PayPal was created specifically to help people exchanging on eBay. But PayPal worked out so much better than that, that it escaped those bounds, and now PayPal is all over the internet. And PayPal is not perfect, but it's an example of how something spontaneously is created in the market to fill a need. And again, there, you know, PayPal has this user agreement. So if you agree with, if you have a dispute with PayPal, then you're going to go to a private arbitrator. You're not going to take the argument to the government. Well, you know, other companies do that as well. I mentioned before that banks do this with each other. When one bank makes an agreement with another bank, they kind of wink at each other and say, if this goes wrong, the last thing we want to do is get government involved, because the inspectors are going to come in and they're going to rip everything apart and we're going to have to deal with them. It's better if we just deal with this between us. So they agree to accept whatever the judgment is of a third party if there's a dispute between them. And in a free market, you would have these throughout the system. You would have even in neighborhoods, you would have people who would serve this purpose. And we know that because that's what happened throughout antiquity. There's all kinds of examples of this happening right up through the Middle Ages, and really even into the 1800s in places like the American West. But as the same way PayPal spontaneously appeared because there was a need in the market, bitcoins are doing the same thing. Bitcoins have developed as a response to despotic government and their money policies. With certain people in society needing to move money around without the government involved, things like that create an atmosphere where something like bitcoins is bound to develop at some point in time, because there's a need in the market to move money without the permission and the oversight of government. Now, in the 1600s, we started to see something developing called mercantile law. And Roderick Long has a really interesting take on that. And I think I'm going to play his clip, a little clip on that. So here you're going to hear Roderick Long talking about mercantile law I'll let Roderick Long explain it.
Another thing is, people often assume that there's going to be less legal uniformity under anarchy than under government, because some people all learn or have their different legal interpretations. But I think there's actually reason to expect that there might be more legal uniformity under anarchy. Example I would point to is the law merchant, which was a system of commercial law during the late Middle Ages and early Renaissance. And part of the story of how it emerged was this. This is a period when international trade was increasing, the mercantile class was growing, there was much more trade going on, and so you had many more cases in which merchants from different countries would be entering into agreements with each other, commercial contracts of various kinds. However, the commercial laws of these countries were lagging behind in the situation. Each country had a different, completely different set of legal standards governing commerce and governing contracts. And it was often the case that the courts of one country simply would not recognize or enforce contracts that were made under the laws of another country. So this is a case where there was insufficient legal uniformity. And so the merchants complained, but the government court is a monopoly, and so they're not that responsive to such complaints. They just said to the merchants, go shove it. So instead, the merchants got together and they formed their own system of commercial law and courts that were international in character. Now, they couldn't enforce these through force because they had governments that were largely monopolizing that. They enforced it primarily through boycotts, through things like credit reports and so forth. If you wouldn't submit your disputes to the merchant court, if you did but you didn't abide by them later, then they'd spread the news saying, here's a person who doesn't abide by the decisions of the merchant court. Take that into account when deciding whether to deal with them. And so this is a case where the mercantile law was actually more uniform than the law that was being provided by government. Well, think about standardization in general. There are all sorts of economic incentives to move toward standardization. One example I like to use is, why are there no triangular credit cards? What if someone decided to start a credit card company and start issuing triangular cards? Is that illegal? Not as far as I know. I mean, I suppose it might be. There are a lot of laws out there. But it doesn't seem as though you have to assume it's illegal in order to understand why no one's doing it. If someone issued triangular credit cards, there wouldn't be much demand for them because, they don't fit in the ATM machine. They don't fit into the machines where they where they take the imprint or where they charge you. They don't fit into wallets very well. So we don't need a law forbidding triangular credit cards. Triangular credit cards are just not going to be that popular. Lots of cases where, look at the fact that it used to be that that PCs and Apples were completely incompatible with each other, that a disk from one couldn't go in the other. And now they're more compatible. It's still not perfect, but they're much more compatible with each other. There wasn't any law saying it. It's just that, you can sell more of your computers if you make them compatible with the other guy's computers. Another reason why we should have reason to doubt Locke's claim that an absence of a generally known legal standards is a problem for anarchy is that states have an incentive to overproduce laws. States have published, regardless of what the content of them is, they publish these huge telephone book size chunks of legislation, and they're just constantly spewing them out. They're just, if you try to keep track of all the laws that Congress passes, and just go with Congress, forget about all the state governments, forget about all the regulatory agencies, just go with what Congress produces. You couldn't possibly read through it all. Even if the content of it was excellent stuff, which I wouldn't count on, and of course, most of the people in Congress have no idea what's in it either. They just know that their favorite special interest thought it would be a good idea to have this in there, and there's probably maybe no one who's actually read the whole bit of any of it, although various people have read various chunks of it. But anyway, there's an incentive for states to do this because they're not restrained by market demand. A market would not want so many laws that you couldn't keep track of what they were. It was very hard to find out what's legal and what's illegal. So that, some regulatory agency will find some chunk of the law that it turns out you violated, but it's very hard for you to know ahead of time. And you can hire teams of lawyers and they'll try to find out for you. I think that states have an incentive to do this in a way that market agencies wouldn't. But I think that if there are so many laws, and they're constantly being produced, and they're constantly changing, I think that's the functional equivalent of there not being a generally known law. You know, it's traditionally part of the idea of a law that it has to be promulgated. You know, it has to be announced to people what it is. Well, you could say these things are promulgated. I mean, there are places where you can go and look it up, but if you couldn't read through all the laws that apply to you in your lifetime, unless you sort of give up everything else and just spend your whole life, reading these things, in some sense, there is no generally known and settled law. It's not known because it's too huge to read. It's not settled because more of it's coming out in vast and readable chunks every month. So I think it's the state that's more likely to be subject to this problem.
I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much.
Okay, now that was Roderick Long talking about mercantile law. So market decisions enforce standards. In the absence of an aggressive government, market decisions enforce standards. In today's society, we have things like Consumers Union is a good organization, free of the government, that looks at products and services and companies and judges them and is entirely independent. And you can read for a small fee, you can subscribe to Consumers Union and get all kinds of information about pretty much any product you can think of, especially the higher end stuff, the more expensive things that you might be considering purchasing. In around 1900, I'm not sure the exact time that they were formed, but there's a company called Underwriters Laboratories, and they in the early days they focused strictly on electrical devices, and they would look them over, they would test them, they would see what kind of quality they were. And if something has the UL or Underwriters Laboratory seal affixed to it, then you know that it's passed their rigorous testing procedures. And so you have some level of confidence when you buy an electrical device with the UL seal attached to it. I knew this right along. I've known this since I was a kid. I've known about Underwriters Laboratory and Consumers Union. But in the early days of eBay, I kind of let that all slip from my mind. And I was looking for a hand grinder to use in my garage on some projects that I was doing. And so I jumped on eBay. And, at the time, a hand grinder was running about $60 or $80. And I found these hand grinders on there for like $20. Actually, I think they were, if I recall, I think they were $14. But I thought, oh, that's great. Look at that. And they were made in China. So I didn't think very much about that. I just went ahead and ordered them. And they got to me pretty quickly, and I was very pleased. I started it up. And as soon as I started it, I noticed that the grinding disc itself had a pretty severe wobble to it. And I thought, well, that's weird. And so I started using it, and it began destroying itself almost immediately. And I just out of curiosity, I took it apart to see what the problem was. And the problem was there were no bearings in the front of this device. It was just a shaft coming out of a motor, turning on an angle through plastic gears rather than metal gears, and then coming out of the shaft coming out of the case attached to the grinding wheel. And the plastic case served as a bearing for it. So it was destined from the first time you started it, it would begin destroying itself from that moment. And the other thing was odd about it, and I started looking it all over, is that if you held it wrong, it would shock you. Not real bad, but it'd give you a little buzz. And so, as I'm looking it all over, of course, there's no Underwriter Laboratory seal affixed to it. And I relearned that lesson with that $14 grinder. You see, given the opportunity, I haven't looked for sure, but I doubt if you can buy those grinders on eBay anymore, because eBay is set up in such a way that when something like that starts to take place, there is feedback mechanisms, and those guys are run, you know, they're run out of town on a rail, if you can think of it in those terms. You know, not literally, there's no rail involved, but they are driven out of the marketplace in that sense. And so I doubt very seriously, I haven't looked, but I doubt very seriously if you can buy those grinders like that. And even if you can buy, you know, Chinese grinders on eBay, I doubt that they're made in that low a quality, because people catch on to it pretty quickly and they put the feedback, and then people don't buy from them and the market dries up, because there is no market for really, really ratty, cheap, falling apart grinders. Nobody wants to pay even $14 for one. It's not going to last even the first time you try to use it. So customary law, which is very similar to what we might call natural law, or what we might consider some of the other forms of law, but customary law serves societies from prehistory through the Middle Ages, and the remnants of it still exist today. When we think of things like the castle doctrine, you know, the right to defend your home, or the right to self-defense, the right to restitution, the right of compensation, all of these come to us not from the state, but from customary law. And they were provided through private courts well up into the 1600s, when the state usurped and absorbed these things. And as a matter of fact, in the 1600s in England, scholars began actually writing down law. And that was the first time in English history that laws were officially written down like that. But there was a problem. There existed no words to describe what was already understood among the people as law. So they had to come up with, they literally had to invent words. And of course they were scholars, so they used Latin as the basis rather than English. And they invented these Latin words to describe laws that were common among the English people. And so it appears, if you start looking up some of these words in legal dictionaries and so forth, it appears that these all just appear, come into existence in the 1600s. But really it was the legal scholars attempting to describe what was already ages old. And so they use Latin words to describe these laws that already existed before the state began usurping usurping law and absorbing it into, as an aspect of the state. Karl Menger, one of the founders, or maybe the founder of the Austrian School of Economics, he said, well, and this is paraphrased from High German, so this is probably not the exact words of Karl Menger. But he said that the origin, formation, and the ultimate process of all voluntary social institutions, including law, is essentially the same as the spontaneous order that drives markets. Markets coordinate interactions as does customary law. Both develop as they do because the actions they are intended to coordinate are performed more effectively under one system or process than another. The more effective institutional arrangements replace the less effective ones. So Karl Menger, even in the 1800s, was saying that law has its origin in a market-like process, in the market for law. That's why law exists, because there is a market for it. And of course, the state has usurped it. Now, sometime back, I did an article, and I referred to this earlier in the podcast, called Why Must the State Forbid the Duel? And you can get over to badquaker.com and get to the show notes for today, and you can find the link to that. But essentially, I make the argument that once humans relinquished the right to duel, and once the governments of the world destroyed the right of people to duel, then an aspect of individual control over law was lost. I've made the argument, and I make the argument in that article, that the state never could have come to its maturity as long as individuals have the right to settle something among themselves through a duel. And again, I make the argument in this article that a duel is, you know, it's not like TV, it's not like the movies. In most cases, it did not involve death. Death was rather rare in a duel. A duel could be anything from actual combat to any kind of a contest, maybe a game of chess. But the thing of it was a binding agreement between two individuals that they could settle among themselves without the government involved. And at the end of that duel, whether it be, you know, a game of chess or swords or guns or whatever, at the end of that agreed upon duel where no aggression took place, keep in mind, there's no aggression if all parties involved are in agreement. So at the end of that process, both parties were bound by honor to hold to it. And they almost always did. And if anybody went through the duel process and then came out the other end as the loser and then didn't honor their word, then oftentimes they were shunned out of society. They were pushed out of the community. No one would do business with them. They were known as a dishonest person. So there were all kinds of pressures that would force a person to stick with their honor and follow through with their word after a duel. So law developed naturally by market forces prior to 1600. In Western culture, the state undertook a metamorphosis about 1600 and began the process of usurping all law. In the 1800s came the outlawing of the duel and ultimately all private law, and the proclamation that a corporation was a person. This was entirely new. In the 1800s, there was legal precedent set that a corporation was a person. So the metamorphosis of the state was almost complete. By around 1900, the new corporate state owned all real estate, controlled the money supply, the primary means of production, was the source of all law, and was the final arbitrator of all disputes, including those disputes involving itself. And folks, all these things were new. All these things were unique to this new corporate state. In the past, it had all been done privately. Every aspect of that had been done privately. But by around 1900, this new corporate state had come to its maturity and had taken over all these aspects of society. And now we face, after 100 years, after generations of dependency, most people can't even imagine law or justice or dispute resolution or any of these things without the aggression of government. We're like those two old ladies in that old Russian joke that I was talking about the other day, that can't imagine bread without the Supreme Soviet handing it to them. Who would make the roads? Who would pick the cotton? Who'll cook us bread? You see? Now, there's one other thing that I can refer to. There's I'll put the link in today's show notes. There's a link to a Murray Rothbard article where he talks about Ireland and how the whole system worked in ancient Ireland, and he goes through with details of every aspect of how arbitration worked and how the courts worked and how laws were enforced and all these things. Now I want to give one more reminder about the contest. When the DVD Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle Volume 1 Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz and a Bad Quitcom t-shirt. And how do you do that? You go to Facebook. You search for badquaker.com, spelled DOTCOM, and you post on the badquaker.com Facebook page these words: I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD. And if you don't have a Facebook account, then you just email badquaker@badquaker.com, put DVD in the subject line, and in the body of the email, put these words: I want to win the Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle DVD. And you send that to badquaker.com. BadQuaker at BadQuaker.com. We promise we won't sell, trade, or do anything else stupid or evil with your email address. The contest will end October 14th, 2012, this coming Sunday. Michael Dean and I will randomly choose a winner, and this is open to U.S. addresses only. We cannot ship this outside the U.S. You must be 21 or over. There's no purchase necessary. It's not valid. We're prohibited by evil overlords. And again, it ends October 14th, 2012. That's this coming Sunday. So if you're hearing this in an archive broadcast, then it's probably already over with. Now, folks, thank you very much for listening today, and thank you for listening through this three-part series. If you missed the first two parts, be sure and get to those. And as always, for more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to badquaker.com, and thank you very much for listening. Goodbye, folks. The following article is an excerpt from For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard, pages 286 through 290, as read by Jeff Riggenbach.
The most remarkable historical example of a society of libertarian law and courts, however, has been neglected by historians until very recently. And this was also a society where not only the courts and the law were largely libertarian, but where they operated within a purely stateless and libertarian society. This was ancient Ireland, an Ireland which persisted in this libertarian path for roughly 1,000 years, until its brutal conquest by England in the 17th century. And in contrast to many similarly functioning primitive tribes, such as the Igbos in West Africa and many European tribes, pre-conquest Ireland was not in any sense a primitive society. It was a highly complex society that was, for centuries, the most advanced, most scholarly, and most civilized in all of Western Europe. For 1,000 years, then, ancient Celtic Ireland had no state or anything like it. As the leading authority on ancient Irish law has written, there was no legislature, no bailiffs, no police, no public enforcement of justice. There was no trace of state-administered justice. How, then, was justice secured? The basic political unit of ancient Ireland was the tuath. All freemen who owned land, all professionals and all craftsmen, were entitled to become members of a tuath. Each tuath's members formed an annual assembly which decided all common policies, declared war or peace on other tuatha, and elected or deposed their kings. An important point is that in contrast to primitive tribes, no one was stuck or bound to a given tuath, either because of kinship or of geographical location. Individual members were free to, and often did, secede from a tuath and join a competing tuath. Often, two or more tuatha decided to merge into a single, more efficient unit. As Professor Joe Peden states, the tuath is thus a body of persons voluntarily united for socially beneficial purposes, and the sum total of the landed properties of its members constituted its territorial dimension. In short, they did not have the modern state with its claim to sovereignty over a given, usually expanding, territorial area, divorced from the landed property rights of its subjects. On the contrary, tuatha were voluntary associations, which only comprised the landed properties of its voluntary members. Historically, about 80 to 100 tuatha coexisted at any time throughout Ireland. But what of the elected king? Did he constitute a form of state ruler? Chiefly, the king functioned as a religious high priest, presiding over the worship rites of the tuath, which functioned as a voluntary religious as well as a social and political organization. As in pagan pre-Christian priesthoods, the kingly function was hereditary, this practice carrying over to Christian times. The king was elected by the tuath from within a royal kin group, which carried the hereditary priestly function. Politically, however, the king had strictly limited functions. He was the military leader of the tuath, and he presided over the tuath assemblies. but he could only conduct war or peace negotiations as agent of the assemblies, and he was in no sense sovereign and had no rights of administering justice over Tuath members. He could not legislate, and when he himself was party to a lawsuit, he had to submit his case to an independent judicial arbiter. Again, how then was law developed and justice maintained? In the first place, the law itself was based on a body of ancient and immemorial custom, passed down as oral and then written tradition through a class of professional jurists called the Brehons. The Brehons were in no sense public or governmental officials. They were simply selected by parties to disputes on the basis of their reputations for wisdom, knowledge of the customary law, and the integrity of their decisions. As Professor Peden states, the professional jurists were consulted by parties to disputes for advice as to what the law was in particular cases, and these same men often acted as arbitrators between suitors. They remained at all times private persons, not public officials. Their functioning depended upon their knowledge of the law and the integrity of their judicial reputations. Furthermore, the Brehons had no connection whatsoever with the individual Tuatha or with their kings. They were completely private, national in scope, and were used by disputants throughout Ireland. Moreover, and this is a vital point, in contrast to the system of private Roman lawyers, the Brehon was all there was. There were no other judges, no public judges of any kind in ancient Ireland. It was the Brehons who were schooled in the law, and who added glosses and applications to the law to fit changing conditions. Furthermore, there was no monopoly, in any sense, of the Brehon jurists. Instead, several competing schools of jurisprudence existed and competed for the custom of the Irish people. How were the decisions of the Brehons enforced? Through an elaborate, voluntarily developed system of insurance, or sureties. Men were linked together by a variety of surety relationships, by which they guaranteed one another for the righting of wrongs and for the enforcement of justice and the decisions of the Brehons. In short, the Brehons themselves were not involved in the enforcement of decisions, which rested again with private individuals linked through sureties. There were various types of surety. For example, the surety would guarantee with his own property the payment of a debt, and then join the plaintiff in enforcing a debt judgment if the debtor refused to pay. In that case, the debtor would have to pay double damages, one to the original creditor and another as compensation to his surety. And this system applied to all offenses, aggressions, and assaults, as well as commercial contracts. In short, it applied to all cases of what we would call civil and criminal law. All criminals were considered to be debtors who owed restitution and compensation to their victims, who thus became their creditors. The victim would gather his sureties around him and proceed to apprehend the criminal or to proclaim his suit publicly and demand that the defendant submit to adjudication of their dispute with the Brehons. The criminal might then send his own sureties to negotiate a settlement or agree to submit the dispute to the Brehons. If he did not do so, he was considered an outlaw by the entire community. He could no longer enforce any claim of his own in the courts, and he was treated to the opprobrium of the entire community. There were occasional wars, to be sure, in the 1,000 years of Celtic Ireland, but they were minor brawls, negligible compared to the devastating wars that racked the rest of Europe. As Professor Peden points out, without the coercive apparatus of the state, which can, through taxation and conscription, mobilize large amounts of arms and manpower, the Irish were unable to sustain any large-scale military force in the field for any length of time. Irish wars were pitiful brawls and cattle raids, by European standards. Thus we have indicated that it is perfectly possible, in theory and historically, to have efficient and courteous police, competent and learned judges, and a body of systematic and socially accepted law, and none of these things being furnished by a coercive government. Government, claiming a compulsory monopoly of protection over a geographical area and extracting its revenues by force, can be separated from the entire field of protection. Government is no more necessary for providing vital protection service than it is necessary for providing anything else. And we have not stressed a crucial fact about government, that its compulsory monopoly over the weapons of coercion has led it, over the centuries, to infinitely more butcheries and infinitely greater tyranny and oppression than any decentralized private agencies could possibly have done. If we look at the black record of mass murder, exploitation, and tyranny levied on society by governments over the ages, we need not be loath to abandon the Leviathan state and try freedom.
For more audio files by Jeff Reganbach, go to Mises.org. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to BadQuaker.com. And thank you for listening.